February 7th, 1999. Kettering, Ohio. 9-year-old Erica Baker leaves her family's home to take a dog for a walk. While a pair of eyewitnesses see Erica in a nearby park, she soon vanishes without a trace, and the dog is found unattended. 6 years later, a suspect named Christian Gabriel is indicted on the charges of evidence tampering and abuse of a corpse after confessing that he was in a van which fatally struck Erica before the responsible parties disposed of her body. Even though Gabriel recants his confession, he winds up serving nearly 6 years in prison, but numerous searches fail to turn up Erica's body, and she continues to remain a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got a unique missing children's case to cover today. The 1999 disappearance of 9-year-old Erica Baker. Cold cases involving children are always difficult to cover, but last year, I actually received separate requests to cover this story from listeners named Art and Clay, so I thought it was about time I did an episode. What really makes this story stand out from other missing children's cases is that even though Erica's body has never been found, a suspect named Christian Gabriel was indicted and convicted for his role in Erica's disappearance and served nearly 6 years in prison before his release. If you're wondering why he received such a light sentence for killing a child, that's because he was indicted on the charges of evidence tampering and abuse of a corpse, not murder. The story goes that Erica was killed in a hit-and-run accident involving a van which may or may not have been driven by Gabriel, that he and at least one other person covered up the crime by burying her body somewhere. However, the problem is that the only real evidence against Gabriel are his own incriminating statements, and he changed his story multiple times before completely recanting his confession. That's not to say that Gabriel is an innocent man who was wrongly convicted, but I don't think his light prison sentence offered much comfort for Erica's family, since they've never been able to give her a proper burial. What further complicates this case is that Gabriel also implicated 3 other people, one of whom is currently deceased, and there would be additional drama involving a public defender who refused to reveal potentially important information due to attorney-client privilege. No matter how you look at it, this is a very frustrating story involving a young girl who is technically still missing, and since it is yet to find a satisfying resolution, we're going to explore the case on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Erica Baker. Our story begins in 1999 in Kettering, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton which has a population of around 57,000 people, and our central figure is 9-year-old Erica Baker. Since her parents are divorced, Erica and her 3 older brothers, Jason, Gregory, and Logan, are currently being raised by her maternal grandmother, Pam Schmidt. The children's mother, Melissa Baker, who goes by the nickname Misty, has just gone through a very difficult stage of her life, having spent the past 4 years struggling with an addiction to crack cocaine. but after spending the last part of 1998 going through a bout of homelessness and serving a 2-week stint in jail, Misty finally made the decision to clean herself up for good. Following her release, she was invited to move in with Pam, so they now occupy the same house with her 4 children, and Misty has recently started a new job. After giving birth to her oldest son, Jason, when she was only 15 years old, Misty hooked up with her future husband, Greg Baker, and they would go on to have 2 sons and a daughter. Even though the marriage came to an end when Erica was only 6 months old, Greg still maintained a relationship with his children and would have frequent visitation with them. On Sunday, February the 7th, after spending the weekend with their father in Huber Heights, Erica and her siblings were dropped off at their grandmother's residence at around 2:30 p.m. At the time, Erica's aunt was also living there with her pet Shih Tzu dog, Jamie, and even though it was a rainy afternoon, Erica asked her mother if she could take Jamie out for a walk through Indian Riffle Park, which was located near the residence. Erica was given permission to do so, so she left the house with the dog sometime between 3 o'clock and 3:15. However, neither Erica nor Jamie returned home, and by the time evening hit, Misty became concerned enough to perform a search of the area with her sons. Even after checking through Indian Riffle Park, they failed to find Erica, so Misty contacted the Kettering Police Department to report her missing. The police launched a massive search effort and had no luck finding Erica either, but it wasn't long before they were contacted by a couple who shared a surprising story. The couple claimed that around 3:45 p.m., about a half hour after Erica left her house, they were walking their own dog through Indian Riffle Park when they saw Erica playing with Jamie next to a pond located behind the Kettering Recreation Complex. Erica and the dog then started walking towards the track of the nearby Kettering Middle School. A short time later, the couple went back through this area and were surprised to find Jamie in the doorway of one of the school's buildings. The dog still had a blue leash attached to him, but he was shivering and shaking and now had a bruise on his back. Since there was no sign of Erica anywhere, the couple decided to call animal control to have Jamie picked up, and he was eventually returned to his family. Later that night, while watching a news report about Erica's disappearance, the couple recognized her as the same girl they had seen in the park and contacted the police. Even though the pond in the park would be drained, it failed to turn up anything. In spite of Misty's past issues with drugs and the law, neither she nor Greg were considered suspects in Erica's disappearance, as they both cooperated with the investigation and passed polygraph tests. When Erica originally left her residence, she was wearing a sweatshirt which had Winnie the Pooh on it, and only a few days after she vanished, a Winnie the Pooh sweatshirt was discovered inside a trash can at Germantown Metro Park, located about 25 miles away from Kettering. While some police bloodhounds seemed to pick up a scent on the shirt, Erica's family did not believe it was the same one she had been wearing, since the design was different, and investigators ultimately concluded that the shirt likely had no connection to the case. Over the course of the next few years, Erica's disappearance would receive coverage on a number of prominent television shows, including America's Most Wanted, Oprah, The Maury Povich Show, and The Montel Williams Show. At one point, actress Sarah Jessica Parker, who happened to be a Cincinnati native, recorded some public service announcements about Erica, urging anyone with information to come forward. But I should also mention that when Misty made an appearance on The Montel Williams Show to spread awareness about her daughter's case, she had the misfortune of crossing paths with notorious self-proclaimed psychic Sylvia Brown. She told Misty that she believed Erica was still alive in Ann Arbor, Michigan, because someone had sold her for drugs, and described having a vision of a black woman who helped throw Erica into a black truck. Well, spoiler alert, Sylvia Brown was 100% wrong. It turned out that police were investigating a rumor that Erica had been the victim of a hit-and-run accident in which she was struck by a van, and the responsible parties covered up the crime by disposing of her body. While differing accounts of this story floated around the community, the most common version involved the occupants of the van being a woman named Jan Franks, her boyfriend, and at least one other person. Franks had a history of criminal activity and drug addiction, and on December the 30th, 2001, she succumbed to a drug overdose at the age of 32 while staying in a homeless shelter. Her death would pave the way for a major legal complication involving a woman named Beth Lewis, a federal public defender who had represented Franks in an unrelated case involving the forgery of a government treasury check. Franks was indicted for this crime in December of 1998, before she was released on bond in January of 1999. She returned to court to plead guilty on March the 16th, for which she received a sentence of 3 years probation and court-ordered drug addiction treatment. Well, since Erica's disappearance had taken place on February the 7th of that year, there was speculation that if Franks was involved in her disappearance, she may have shared some information with Beth Lewis. When Franks first popped up on the radar as a potential suspect, she refused to cooperate and speak with the police, so Erica's grandmother, Pam Schmidt, took the initiative of writing some letters to Franks in which she urged her to come forward and tell the truth. While Franks never responded to these letters, Pam did receive a phone call from Lewis, who told her to stop bothering her client. While following Franks' death, Lewis was pressured to reveal if Franks had ever said anything to her about Erica's case. On June the 26th, 2002, Lewis was subpoenaed by the Montgomery County Prosecutor's Office to appear in front of a grand jury, but she refused to reveal anything, stating that her conversations with Franks were protected by attorney-client privilege. However, it turned out that Ohio had a previously untested 50-year-old law which stated that a client's spouse had the right to waive attorney-client privilege on their behalf after the client was deceased, so Jan Franks' estranged husband, Shane Franks, agreed to sign a confidentiality waiver which granted Lewis permission to share any information she knew. But in spite of this, Lewis did not believe he had the authority to do this, arguing that this law only applied to probate matters, not criminal cases. When she refused to answer most of the questions she received at the grand jury proceeding, Montgomery County Common Pleas Judge Michael T. Hall held her in contempt of court, but Lewis would be allowed to stay out of jail while she appealed the decision. In the meantime, the investigation would place all their focus on another suspect, Jan Franks' 33-year-old former boyfriend, Christian Gabriel. In 1999, Franks' husband was serving time in prison for robbery, which is why she became involved with Gabriel, who was rumored to be the owner of the van that supposedly struck Erica. In fact, it turned out that Gabriel had sold a van he owned to another individual only 16 days after Erica went missing. In July of that year, Gabriel was questioned by detectives from the Kettering Police Department, where he admitted that he and some friends had shoplifted from a local Meijer supermarket on February the 7th and made the odd statement that, quote-unquote, something could have happened while they were returning to his apartment that day. However, the investigation into Gabriel came to a standstill when his former van was turned over to the Miami Valley Regional Crime Laboratory for a forensic examination, and they could find no evidence which linked the van to Erica. Police did not question Gabriel again until 2004, and he changed his story, now claiming that he had lent his van to someone else on the day Erica went missing. In July of that year, Gabriel was arrested by the Clark County Sheriff's Office for receiving stolen property, and while he was being transported to the police station, he openly complained about how the Kettering Police Department was screwing with him over the Erica Baker case. When they arrived, Gabriel agreed to be interviewed about the case, and he soon made a full confession to his involvement. Gabriel reverted back to his original story about having shoplifted at a Meijer supermarket on the day of Erica's disappearance, and said that he was accompanied by Jan Franks and his two roommates at the time, a married couple named Clifford and Sabrina Butts. According to Gabriel, both he and Franks were under the influence of drugs and alcohol, and while they were at the supermarket, they noticed a police officer arrive near the scene. Even though the officer was there to investigate an unrelated accident, they became paranoid that she was there for them, prompting them to climb into Gabriel's van and speed away. Gabriel claimed that Franks was driving the van while he sat in the passenger seat and the Buttses were in the back. He said they were speeding westbound on Glengarry Drive and that a number of cars were parked by the side of the street because a hockey tournament was taking place at the Kettering Recreation Complex that afternoon. But as they were reaching the intersection of Powhatan Place, Erica suddenly emerged from between two parked cars, and Gabriel said that he then heard a loud thud. When Frank stopped the van, They climbed out and discovered Erica's body lying on the road, and even though he did not see any blood, Gabriel described her body as being twisted and broken. This caused everyone to go into a panic, so they proceeded to load Erica's body into the van and drive away. They then decided to travel to Gabriel's apartment to smoke some crack cocaine while they figured out what to do next. Gabriel claimed that he originally wanted to take Erica to a hospital, but since he and Franks both had prior criminal records, they ultimately made the decision to cover the whole thing up. Finally, at around 10 p.m., the four of them transported Erica's body to the Huffman Metro Park, located near the Huffman Dam. Gabriel said he remained in the van for around 30 minutes, while the others took Erica and buried her. Gabriel took investigators to a spot near Huffman Dam to help search for Erica's body, but nothing was found. Gabriel would remain incarcerated until he agreed to plead guilty to the stolen property charge and received a 9-month prison sentence at the Correctional Reception Center in Orient. In December, detectives from the Kettering Police Department decided to interview Gabriel, and he would once again confess to his involvement in Erica's disappearance. But this time, he now claimed that he was the driver of the van when it struck her, and Jan Franks was the only other person who was present. He said Franks provided him with directions to a location in Caesars Creek State Park, and that he personally dug a shallow grave and buried Erica's body. Even though Gabriel led investigators down the exact route he drove that day, and accompanied them on another search for Erica's remains, they still failed to find anything. Well, even though no other evidence could be found to corroborate Gabriel's story, the case was taken to a Montgomery County grand jury, and on February the 4th, 2005, they decided to indict Gabriel on the charges of evidence tampering and gross abuse of a corpse. They had the option to indict Gabriel on additional charges, such as aggravated murder or vehicular homicide, but felt that the evidence was not sufficient enough to do so. In fact, the statute of limitations on the charges Gabriel did receive was 6 years, and his indictment took place only 3 days before they were set to expire. Even though Gabriel had implicated Clifford and Sabrina Butts as being present when Erica's death took place and participating in the cover-up, neither of them were indicted. Well, within months of his indictment, Gabriel changed his story yet again, now maintaining that his entire confession was false. He claimed that he did not even own a van at the time Erica's disappearance took place, and only made up his story after being pressured by the police. Gabriel pled not guilty to all the charges against him, and while his defense team filed a motion to suppress all the statements Gabriel had made to law enforcement, it was denied. Gabriel finally went on trial in October, but after deliberating for only 3 hours, the jury found him guilty on all charges. He would be sentenced to 5 years in prison for evidence tampering, along with an additional sentence of 1 year for gross abuse of a corpse. The sentences would be served consecutively, and upon hearing this, Gabriel cursed at the judge and had to be dragged out of the courtroom. Meanwhile, while all this was going on, Beth Lewis had spent the past 3.5 years appealing the ruling from the Montgomery County Court of Common Pleas that attorney-client privilege be waived and she be forced to answer questions about Jan Franks. Her case would be heard by a number of higher courts, including the Supreme Court of Ohio and the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, but they all upheld the original decision. On January the 24th, 2006, Lewis was finally summoned to testify in front of a Montgomery County grand jury. But since these proceedings are always kept secret from the public, it's unknown what Lewis may or may not have said, though it obviously did not help lead to the recovery of Erica's remains. While he made at least one unsuccessful attempt to appeal his conviction, Christian Gabriel would remain in prison until June of 2011. After his sentences were completed, he was immediately handed over to the Mercer County Sheriff's Office to serve some additional time for unpaid fines related to an old domestic violence conviction. But believe it or not, when Gabriel appeared in municipal court for a hearing, Erica's grandmother, Pam Schmidt, made an appearance to speak on his behalf, expressing her desire for Gabriel to be released because his son was ill at that time. Gabriel's release was granted, and when he walked out of the county jail, Pam actually showed up at the curb to give him a ride. They then drove to a restaurant, where Pam conversed with Gabriel and appealed to him to reveal the location of Erica's remains. Unfortunately, even though Gabriel said he was sorry about what happened, he claimed he could not remember anything. Gabriel has reportedly moved to another state, and to this day, he has not divulged any additional information about Erica's case. The police have also stated that they will not perform any more searches for Erica unless new evidence emerges, which might lead them to the exact spot where she is buried. So officially, Erica Baker continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, this is definitely one of the more unique missing persons cases I've ever covered on this podcast, because from a technical standpoint, the trail has not gone cold here. But it also ranks as one of the most frustrating missing persons cases we've ever covered. Everyone involved seems to believe that they found the right perpetrator, and while he has served some time in prison for the crime, it's hardly a satisfying conclusion. If Christian Gabriel really is guilty of causing Erica Baker's death, then he probably got off way too easy, because even if it was legitimately an accident, 6 years is way too lenient a punishment for taking the extra step of disposing her body and failing to recover it. But if by chance, Gabriel is actually innocent, then the authorities have spent the past 2 decades chasing after false leads, while some other perpetrator has gotten away with it. Now, I'm certainly not trying to imply that the police got the wrong guy, but literally the only evidence they had against Gabriel were his own confessions, but he also changed his story multiple times and recanted before he went on trial. False confessions are one of the biggest causes of wrongful convictions, and while I wouldn't go so far as to classify this as a wrongful conviction, that doesn't change the fact that without a body or any physical evidence, there has never really been anything to corroborate Gabriel's statements. Since Gabriel has already served his time, you might be wondering why he won't just come clean and reveal the location of Erica's body, but remember, he was convicted on the charges of evidence tampering and gross abuse of a corpse, not murder. If Erica's remains were recovered, I guess there's always the risk that it might lead to the discovery of additional evidence, which could mean more charges for Gabriel. However, when Gabriel spoke to Pam Schmidt following his release from prison, I don't get the impression that he flat out denied being responsible for Erica's death. He just told her he was sorry, but that he couldn't remember anything because of all the drugs he was on at that time. So perhaps Gabriel was telling the truth about accidentally hitting Erica with his ban and burying her body in a park somewhere, but because of the passage of time and the effects of drugs on his memory, he legitimately cannot recall or find the exact location where she's buried. The whole thing is definitely a heartbreaking situation for Erica's family. Her grandmother Pam sounds like a pretty remarkable woman, as she pretty much had to take the reins and raise Erica and her siblings during the 1990s, while their mother was going through some serious personal problems, and of course, she actually took the step of picking up Gabriel after he was released for a one-on-one conversation. This is not the only case I've seen in which a victim's family member has spoken with the alleged perpetrator face to face and appealed for them to finally do the right thing and reveal what they did with the victim's body. I'm always amazed when they are able to maintain their composure and not lash out at them, even though they are likely responsible for the death of their loved one. Even after he completed his sentence, Gabriel could have served additional jail time for a prior issue, but Pam actually lobbied for his release, because Gabriel's own child was ill at that time, so I think she was trying to appeal to his paternal instincts to compel him to tell the truth. What makes the situation even more tragic is that Erica's mother Misty had spent years struggling with drug addiction, homelessness, and troubles with the law before she finally made the decision to clean herself up for good, yet only months later, her daughter goes missing. Under those circumstances, it wouldn't have been too surprising if Misty reverted back to her old lifestyle, but to her credit, it looks like Misty has continued to remain on the straight and narrow. It's interesting how you can draw parallels between Misty and Jan Franks, as they both had a serious addiction to crack cocaine. But while Misty finally got her life back in order, Franks wound up overdosing at a homeless shelter a few years later, and if she was involved in Erica's disappearance, you have to wonder if guilt might have been a contributing factor in her downward spiral. And then there's Erica's father, Greg Baker, who also expressed guilt over how events played out. On the night she went missing, Erica was hoping to attend a father-daughter dance with Greg at the Kettering Recreational Complex, but Greg was unable to make a reservation and purchase tickets in time. Erica was reportedly upset about this, and Greg has always been haunted by the possibility that if they had made plans to go to the dance, Erica might not have gone back home and taken the dog out for a walk, and things could have turned out differently. Sadly, when Gabriel went on trial, one of the initial strategies from his defense team was to divert suspicion towards Greg, alleging that his alibi on the day of Erica's disappearance was weak, and that he had molested some other children years earlier. However, since they were unable to produce any evidence to support these molestation allegations, the court concluded this was not relevant, and overruled the request to submit it as evidence at the trial. Right from the outset, the police had ruled out Greg as a suspect, and he continues to remain a tireless advocate for his daughter. Anyway, if the scenario about Erica being struck by a van and transported away from the scene is true, then the timeline of events does fit. We have a couple who saw Erica with the dog, Jamie, near the pond behind the Kettering Recreation Complex at 3:45 p.m., and then came across the unattended dog while going back through that same area a short time later. The area was located right next to Glengarry Drive, which is where Erica was supposedly hit. Jamie's leash was still attached, and he also apparently had a bruise on his back. So if Erica was crossing the street and still holding on to the leash when she was struck by the van, the impact might have caused her to pull the leash back in such a manner that it wound up bruising Jamie's back, and he subsequently ran back into the park after her body was taken away. Now, I can think of a number of missing persons cases where a victim was last seen walking down a road before they seemingly vanished into thin air. In most of these cases, abduction is the most likely scenario, but sometimes you will see speculation about the possibility of an accidental hit and run, where the responsible party loaded the victim's body into their vehicle and drove away from the scene to cover up what they did. I've seen this theory presented in a few unsolved cases, such as the 2000 disappearance of 9-year-old Aisha Degree, who vanished after she was last seen walking down the side of a highway in the middle of the night. However, I'd really be curious to know how often this scenario actually happens. It seems to me that if you accidentally hit someone with a vehicle and don't want to face the consequences, your most logical strategy would be to speed away from the scene as quickly as possible, because if there aren't any eyewitnesses around, it would be very difficult to link you to the crime. It just seems like going to the trouble of loading the victim's body into your vehicle is incredibly risky and greatly increases the chances of getting caught. I mean, I could see doing this if you accidentally hit someone on a deserted road in the middle of nowhere, but this incident supposedly took place in the middle of the afternoon on a suburban street, which was lined with parked cars because a hockey tournament was taking place in the Kettering Recreation Complex. I've looked at satellite images of this location on Google Maps, and the intersection of Glengarry Drive and Powhatan Place is a very short distance from the rec center, and there are also a number of houses along the road. Given the circumstances, it is surprising that no one reported seeing or hearing anything unusual that afternoon. And even though a massive search effort took place in this area after Erica went missing, no physical evidence was ever found to suggest a hit-and-run took place, and the police bloodhounds apparently never picked up Erica's scent at that intersection. However, given that it was a rainy afternoon, perhaps this washed most of the physical evidence away. Now, even though I just spoke about how illogical it would be for people who committed a hit-and-run to go to the trouble of loading the victim's body into their vehicle in a suburban neighborhood, Gabriel and his associates were supposedly high on drugs and alcohol that afternoon, so we're not talking about people in a rational state of mind. In Gabriel's original confession, He claimed that they all went to his apartment and smoked crack cocaine for a couple of hours before they decided to dispose of Erica's body, which is an incredibly stupid thing to do. These are not people who would be thinking logically. It's interesting to compare the differing stories Gabriel provided in his confessions. The first time around, he attempted to paint himself in the best possible light, claiming that Jan Franks was driving the van when it struck Erica, and he was the lone voice of reason who wanted to take her to the hospital until the others convinced him to cover the whole thing up. And then he claims that he stayed behind in the van the entire time while they went out and buried Erica's body somewhere. So this definitely reeks of someone who wants to alleviate his guilt and confess about what he did, but he also wants to twist the facts in order to minimize his own responsibility. But the confession which ultimately led to Gabriel getting indicted was one in which he placed himself behind the wheel when the van struck Erica, and instead of implicating Jan Franks, Clifford Butts, and Sabrina Butts, he claimed that Franks, who was deceased by this point, was the only other person involved. Now, Robert Green, a Kettering police detective who worked this case and interviewed Gabriel multiple times, he has also been openly skeptical of Gabriel's claims that he could not remember things well because he was on drugs that day. According to Green, some of the details Gabriel has provided are so vivid that they give off the impression that he still has a clear memory of what happened. I know that one of the biggest points of debate about Gabriel's confessions at his trial was whether or not he provided details about the crime he only could have known if he was there. A key detail which convinced investigators that Gabriel was involved was when he provided a description of Jamie the Shih Tzu and the mustache he had, which suggested he really crossed paths with the dog that day. However, Gabriel's defense team argued that a photo of Jamie was put on display during the original media coverage of the case, and Gabriel could have seen him there. We know that Gabriel has led the police to multiple locations where he claimed Erica's body was buried, but they never found anything, and you can interpret this in a number of different ways. Gabriel could legitimately not remember where she's buried and is confused about the location. He might be playing games to toy with the police, or he was actually telling the truth when he said that the police pressured him into making a confession, and he is not actually involved. It's worth noting that on the day Gabriel was indicted, the warden at the correctional institution where he was being held claimed that Gabriel made a statement to him about how he didn't know where the others put Erica's body because he was new to the area and not all that familiar with it at that time. So if Gabriel can't lead anyone to the location of her remains, you have to wonder if there's anyone else out there who can. Well, this leads to one of the most frustrating elements of this case, and that's the entire saga involving Jan Franks and the supposed attorney-client privilege she had with her public defender, Beth Lewis. Looking back through the newspaper archives, it's incredible to see just how much this side story dominated the media coverage of this case, and it just dragged on and on for years. I know that there were a lot of people who thought that Lewis was some sort of heartless villain for refusing to divulge information which could potentially lead to the recovery of a missing girl, but some experts, including the Ohio Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, did defend her, as they believed that even if a client was deceased, it was still a slippery legal slope to break attorney-client privilege about prior conversations with them. Well, here's a very odd coincidence. The February 9, 1999 edition of the Mansfield News Journal features a write-up about Erica Baker's recent disappearance on their front page, but right below that, there was a completely unrelated article which mentions Beth Lewis, who was serving as the public defender for a homeless man who had been charged with bank robbery. Even though tons of evidence, including $4,000 in cash, a mask, and a sawed-off shotgun, was found inside a dumpster the suspect was occupying, Lewis filed a motion for all the evidence to be thrown out. Her argument was that since her client was technically living in that dumpster at the time, the police should have gotten a warrant before they searched for evidence in there. Her strategy didn't work, but I think the incident demonstrates that Lewis was a pretty unconventional attorney, to say the least. Whether you support Lewis's decision to remain silent or not, I think the most infuriating part of all this drama is that it never actually led anywhere. After appealing the higher courts for 3.5 years, Lewis was finally ordered to testify in a closed grand jury proceeding, but after all that, it's never been revealed what she actually said. I'm guessing she didn't say anything particularly useful, since Erica is still a missing person, but it's crazy to think that Gabriel had already gone on trial and was convicted before this even happened. What if Lewis had shared something which completely exonerated Gabriel and proved he was innocent? If Jan Franks never actually shared anything about the case with Lewis, then it's odd that Lewis wouldn't have simply said so right from the start, and I'd hate to think she put Erica's family through the ringer for nothing. And then there's the matter of Clifford and Sabrina Butts, who were Gabriel's roommates at the time this took place, and seemed to be the wild cards in this case. In Gabriel's original confession, he claimed that the Buttses were present in the van when Erica was hit, and that they helped dispose of her body, but in his second confession, he said that he and Franks were the only ones involved. There isn't a ton of information out there about Clifford Butts, but he does have a criminal history, and he was actually quite active during the early stages of the investigation. He told police that he heard rumors about Erica being in a hit-and-run accident, and he was the one who helped put Gabriel on the radar as a potential suspect in the first place when he gave them Gabriel's name in July of 1999. However, Butts also apparently told police about a potential scenario where Erica was kidnapped for sexual reasons and led them to a couple of different locations where she might be buried, but they never found anything. At one point, the Kettering police chief described Butts' stories as quote-unquote fairy tales, though he did acknowledge there seemed to be some truth in the tips he provided. While neither Clifford or Sabrina were indicted by the grand jury, Sabrina was called upon to testify at Gabriel's trial. By this point, Sabrina had split up with Clifford and denied any involvement in Erica's disappearance. She also stated that she found it very unlikely that Gabriel would have let Franks drive his van during that time period, implying that if anyone from their group hit Erica, it would have been him. It is interesting that one of the rumors which apparently spread around the community is that Erica was struck by a van occupied by Franks, her boyfriend, and one other person. So could this mean that even if Sabrina was not in the van when the accident took place, Clifford might have been? It's unclear to me if the decision not to indict Clifford was based on a lack of evidence, or if they legitimately believed he was not involved. The fact that he kept inserting himself into the investigation makes me wonder if he did know something, but I have no idea what Butts is up to today. If he was involved, he's another person who might know the location of Erica's remains and could be the last hope of finding her if Gabriel never talks. But I guess the key question is, even if Gabriel is guilty of causing Erica's disappearance, are any of his accounts about what happened actually accurate? Remember, we have no witnesses to this alleged hit and run, and no forensic evidence was found at the scene or inside Gabriel's van. I definitely think it's a very suspicious coincidence that Gabriel sold off his van to someone else only 16 days after Erica went missing, which suggests that he wanted to get rid of it awfully quickly. Theoretically, he could have done a thorough cleaning of the van before he gave it away, though once again, being an admitted drug addict, would Gabriel have been able to do a thorough enough job to have gotten rid of all trace evidence? This is why I've always wondered if there's a piece of this story still missing here. Now, even though Gabriel and Franks had extensive criminal records, there's nothing in their backgrounds to suggest that they were the type of people who would intentionally abduct and murder a 9-year-old girl, so I am willing to concede that if they were responsible for Erica's death, it was purely accidental. But is there something else which keeps preventing Gabriel from wanting to tell the full truth about this? Well, as horrific as this might be to consider, I think the worst-case scenario is that Erica might have still been alive when her body was loaded into the van following the accident, meaning that her life could have been potentially saved if they had gotten her the proper medical attention. But if the perpetrators feared they would face legal trouble if they admitted to what they did, then perhaps they made a calculated decision to end Erica's life on their own, which would technically make them murderers. If this is what took place, then it might explain why Gabriel has always been reluctant to share the full truth. Maybe he fears that if Erica's remains are discovered, it will reveal that she was not simply the victim of a hit-and-run accident. Overall, in spite of the lack of hard evidence which links Gabriel to this crime, I do think the chances of him being completely innocent and someone else being responsible for Erica's disappearance are very remote. But unlike many of the other cases featured on The Trail Went Cold, this one could potentially be solved in a heartbeat. We have someone who has already served time in prison for the crime, so literally all they would have to do is make a full confession and lead the authorities to Erica's remains. I've come up with a number of potential reasons why Gabriel will not do this, but I think the simplest explanation is that he's a coward, and until he does the right thing, this very solvable case will continue to remain shrouded in mystery. However, it's possible there are other people who might know something, so if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Erica Baker, please contact the Kettering Police Department at 937-296-2583. That's 937-296-2583. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode in which I discussed and analyzed the famous Unsolved Mysteries Halloween special, which aired on television in October of 1988 and featured four very memorable segments about ghosts. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ani M, Laura D, Nicole D, Alicia K, Beth H, and Karen. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for the newest season of the acclaimed podcast, True Crime Bullshit.
On November 19th of 2018, True Crime Bullshit premiered with the story of Israel Keyes. Over two seasons and 29 hours, we dug deep into Keyes' travels, interviews, confessions, transactions, kill kits, bank robberies, personal life, and known and potential murder victims. And with more than 10 million downloads, new tips, new leads, new sightings, and new sources came in, and the investigation never stopped. 2 years later, season 4 of True Crime Bullshit returns to its roots and finds we'd barely even cracked the surface in the story of Israel Keyes. True Crime Bullshit and Israel Keyes come barging back into your ears on November 12th, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.